This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress, cave suit maker extraordinaire. She's a one-woman business based in Philly, and she'll make some hardy caving apparel for you. Sturdy cave suits with bat stencils and strong material, thick Cordura all over. Twice as thick where it counts, abrasion points like knees, elbows, butts. It'll protect you as you move through the cave so you can cave faster and more efficiently. Sophie started making leggings and other things, and so she really knows what she's doing. And when she started caving, she noticed there wasn't a lot of options in the way of cave suits, so she decided to make her own. And I can tell you from personal experience that Sophie's cave suits can hold their own against almost any other suit out there, and they look a lot cooler, too. So if you didn't get anything for the holidays, or if you didn't get what you wanted, or if you want 2024 to be the year you get underground a lot more, visit SophieReaptress.com and check out all the colors and ways you can customize your own cave suit. They're all made to order at SophieReaptress.com. You can also find her on Instagram at SophieReaptress or click the link in the description. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. If you're just finding this podcast, welcome. In my humble opinion, caving is the ultimate adventure. Not only are you outdoors, kind of, more or less, but you're using all of the parts of your body to move through a space. Sometimes you're crawling, sometimes you're stoop walking, sometimes you're swimming. You're using muscles you almost never use. Plus, for a lot of us, it's a mental workout too, not just to quell the anxiety of any number of aspects of being in a cave, which some of us, even lifelong cavers, get that anxiety, but also to find the route or the frontier. Caving is among the last relatively accessible opportunities to go where nobody has gone before if you get into real cave exploration. And really the best way to do that is to get involved in a grotto. In the United States, a grotto is a local chapter of the NSS, the National Speleological Society. But if you're not in the United States, there are caving clubs all over the world. I have a link to the NSS's page on what a grotto is and how to find yours. And it's right there in the description of this podcast. You can just go there and click it right now. You can do it right now if you want. If you're not completely broke after the holidays, we can still give to our local grottos, right? Or Karst Conservancies or the NSS. If you can do that, I would highly encourage it. What might seem small to you really adds up if the next person or the next person gives. And the caving world is kind of a small one, but a lot of us listen to this podcast. And if everybody listening gave just a few dollars to the NSS or their grotto or a conservancy, that would add up to several thousand dollars going toward cave conservation, education, community building, and all the great things we get from being involved in the caving world. So please, please consider doing that if you can. I got a great present, caver present, in the mail from the very first guest that was ever on this podcast, Ron Adams. He is a member of Muchos Garcias, who performed at Tag Fall Cave-In this year, last year, I guess, 23. And he sent me their whole set. It was so cool. And if you've ever seen Muchos Garcias, maybe you saw him at Tag Fall Cave-In, you know that they like to take popular songs and rework some of the lyrics to make them fit caving, which is great. Not only is it kind of funny, but it's pretty cool. Great musicians, those folks in Muchos Garcias. If you ever get the chance to see him, definitely take it. Thanks, Ron. Happy New Year, by the way. I feel like I say this every year, but I want this year to be the year I do a lot more caving. I have little kids, so it's hard to get out, but they're reaching an age where going caving makes a little more sense. So I hope to take them a little more this year, but also to go on some of my own trips. I came to the end of 2023 with so many vacation days left on the table, and that's shameful, and that's on me. So I intend to use them this year. Maybe some long weekends in Tag, maybe convention, bridge day, finally, maybe. Stay tuned. I'm so glad to be kicking off the year with this episode. So we get right to one of the reasons this month's guest is special at the top of the interview, but Rand is a very special guest for a great number of reasons. He's currently leading the exploration of Indiana's longest cave, the 46-mile Binkley Cave System, a sinkhole plain cave near Corydon, Indiana. But also, as you'll hear, he's a great storyteller, he's got a lot of story to tell. This is part one of a two-parter. I was so delighted to spend almost 3 hours talking to Rand in person. I rarely get the luxury of doing these interviews across the room from the guests. Usually it's over Zoom, which is fine. But he came all the way up to Indianapolis from Corydon in the middle of the work week to do this, and it was so wonderful. Any opportunity to talk to Rand is always great, but to do it in this sort of official capacity to get his oral history was such a pleasure. And once again, I got to combine two things I love into one activity, interviewing cavers and vintage microphones. Nobody cares about this but me, but in case you do, Rand is doing this interview on a 1960s era Shure 556 broadcast microphone. And as you'll hear, well, she still sounds great. So without further ado, Happy New Year. Here's me and intrepid Hoosier caver, Rand Haislett. So, Rand, did you know that you were the very first person that was ever recommended for this podcast?
I had no clue.
You were the very first person.
Are you serious?
Yeah. You were when I started the podcast in 2016, in September, I remember it vividly. I was on vacation in Boston, actually, with my parents and my wife and my sister, and we were just leaving some museum or something. I see this email come in from Nick Benton.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Nick was like, man, I love this. You know, by that point, I was only two or three episodes deep. And he was like, man, I love this podcast. This is great. I can't wait to hear more. You know who you need to talk to? You need to talk to Rand.
Oh, wow.
And well, I was like, well, believe me, I've read all kinds of stuff with his name thrown around. And yeah, I would love to talk to Rand. I didn't really know you at the time. I knew your face, but here we are.
That's fabulous, yeah. And what a great recommendation. Nick's such an amazing caver and such a good human being, you know. So we spent a lot of time underground.
Yeah. Well, and his dad was on the podcast, too.
Yeah, John. Yeah, and then their father, Leo Benton, I think it was. I think that's right. You know, he was always involved in caving, so they got quite a history. But, yeah, no, John was one of the earlier people, the ISS, India's Biological Survey, that I got involved with. So I've gotten to cave with multiple generations, you know, both John and Nick. And so even found the cave and opened it up, I think, 1908 cave or something like that with John Benton and stuff. But I've done a number of things with him, but he's quite the historian.
Oh, my gosh,
Yeah.
It was so cool to sit across from him and talk about that kind of stuff. And he showed me, I think, the book. He had just finished a Floyd Collins book at the time.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he's got a little piece for about any cave you can think of.
Oh, his his knowledge is expansive. I mean, it's truly amazing.
Yeah. So, thank you for coming to my house all the way from Corydon. It's nice to be sitting across from somebody in the flesh.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and that's certainly the way I would prefer to do it, definitely.
Well, I thank you for that. So, I mean, where do we even start?
Well,
with you?
I guess from the beginning.
Might as well.
A little background. You know, caving's just kind of been a part of me since I grew up. I was fortunate to grow up in a place, it was actually Floyd's Knobs, part of southern Indiana.
Yeah.
We could see Louisville, Kentucky from where we lived. Not a real big thick bedding of limestone, but enough that it had a cave and it had cliffs, kind of like if you know Clifty Falls in Indiana. Had that at my home. We had like a 75-foot waterfall.
Really?
And a 45-foot waterfall. And then on the other side was just this little cave that was in the hole, just a little hole in the side of the hill. And coming up along our property was the old route for the stagecoach trail to Vincennes. And so there was just a lot of history there and wonderful views and thousands of acres to go play on a kid. And I mean, I just grew up on the cliffs and running around out there. And that little cave kind of ended up being, you know, they called it Spicker Knob Cave. And even the ISS, I found out later on the Indiana Biological Survey, surveyed that cave. But it kind of led me to where I am today in many ways.
So is that the official name that it still goes by in the ISS?
I think it's in the cave database, even as Spickard Knob Cave. It'd be in Floyd County. There's not a lot of Floyd County caves.
Has it been, like, surveyed? Is there a map of it that exists?
Oh, I have no idea. It's really small. I mean, it's – okay, so you go in and it's like this little keyhole little cave that goes back in about 15 feet, and then you can go straight ahead into a little crawl. I mean, and it's a little crawl, belly crawl. Wow. Or you can go off the left-hand side, and if you did everything just right, you could get about 7 kids crammed in on top of each other in this room over there. And it kind of became our clubhouse, but it was just like, oh my gosh, this is really cool. You know, here we are, and there were crickets, and there were spiders, and there were all this other stuff in there.
The ultimate kid adventure story.
Well, I mean, yeah. And then, yeah, between that and running on the cliffs and stuff, which where I learned how to rappel and my first experiences were rope right there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was back in the day, you know, when you were using carabiners and stuff to rappel on and knots to climb. And, you know, I even have a picture somewhere about 12 years old doing that.
Yeah. Was it like I don't know, like a storybook type entrance? You said like a keyhole entrance. So it was just a little hole in the ground, or was it like a...
No, it was into the side of the hill, you know, truly a keyhole, you know, kind of free attic almost looking kind of passage going back into the hillside.
Okay.
And then there was a spring just to the right of it, about another 50 yards away maybe, that was probably all related. But, I mean, the limestone there, it's mostly siltstone and, you know, glacial moraine that's pushed up, so the bedding of the limestone's only about 10, 15 feet tall, probably. Yeah. So not real big caves, but, you know, enough to get excited about.
Yeah, especially as a kid. I mean, did you have any sense as a kid at how, I don't know, special that place was? Or did it just seem like normal, like everybody's got something like this, right?
We knew, my sister and I, we were the only sibling I had, and we knew we were living someplace special.
Yeah.
I mean, it just was really a cool spot. I don't know. Nature's always been really important to me and kind of, you know, it's kind of my grounding point. And I've always really felt akin to places that are special. And that place had a special energy between the rocks, the cliffs, and the caves and all. It was just a really special place to grow up.
And then another special place came a little later, right? Wyandotte? Didn't you have some history of Wyandotte?
Okay, so, yeah, so we were... Kind of started out there with the caves and stuff and all. Our sixth grade had a science camp, and we went to – part of that was going to Wyandotte Cave. Mm. We stayed at Harrison Crawford County Forestry and this little bunkhouse thing that they had, and we had a weekend, like, getaway or something. But one of the things was that we went to Wyandotte Cave, and I remember going in there and going, oh, my gosh, this is so amazing, you know, and seeing all the history as well as, you know, just all this amazing passage stuff. I'm just sitting there in awe of what this is. And you finally end up in – the Mountain Room, which is where they do their show. I don't know if you've been to Wyandotte Cave or not when they've done the
finally
thing.
I finally just went this past during Capers.
I went back again too. It was a nice revisit. So I got in there and I'm sitting there, and here's this first girl that I've ever been interested in, and sixth grades, and they turn out the lights, and so I reach over and hold this girl's hand, and then they do the show with the scary thing with the shadows coming down at all. And it's like all of a sudden this big impression, you know, of two things that are really cool, you know? Girls and caves. You know? I mean, it's like what can you say? But I mean, yeah. So Wyandotte Cave there kind of got me started, and I came back and I couldn't stop talking, and so. So, you know, that whole summer and stuff and all, we were playing more and more in the cave. And so seventh grade came around and stuff. And, you know, so I went from, you know, elementary school to at that time junior high school. Seventh grade was junior high school. And had some neighbor kids, because where I lived, neighbors were very far away. There weren't a lot of kids. Mm. You had the closest set of kids was about a mile away. But these kids would walk up to catch the bus where we were. And we ended up playing in this cave. And another person that became a good friend, actually my best friend, he was driving by, and the other thing we're swimmers. He was driving by and saw us playing on the cave up in the hill, and he made his dad stop. And all of a sudden, we had a crew.
Yeah.
You know? And next thing we knew, the two kids, the Merkel boys, the two boys that were coming up playing, and then Phil Hutzman and I went to Wyandotte Cave for the all-day tour. with the father of the Merkel boys.
So this was like a, was this like a crawling tour and stuff?
No, no. I mean, well, there was crawling and stuff in it, but I mean, we actually got to see big chunk of Wyandotte Cave, just, you know, some of the nicest parts, and it was an 8-hour trip.
Pillar?
No, the pillar is a half-day trip.
Okay.
This was, the 8-hour was more.
Okay.
And then there was some crawling and stuff all involved, and, you know, and you, they send you back to this rotunda room and different things and stuff. But, I mean, it was just like all of a sudden we were completely on fire and eaten up by caves.
I mean, one trip into there.
And it was all over. Yeah, it was.
That's an amazing place.
So we came back, and of course, immediately, what am I doing? We're digging on every little hole on the property. I mean, there's no hope that it's
going to go. You were already a digger.
But but we were already digging on these holes and stuff and trying to make them go. And it got so bad, finally, that my parents started taking us and dropping us off at caves. A friend had gotten a hold of the Caves of Indiana book, and so we started doing that, and all of a sudden we were doing some caving. So continued my interest in caving and swimming. I was a big swimmer, so that was my sport. And so the swimmers seemed to kind of merge over into the cavers now. It was kind of like, you know, we were excited at adventure and, you know, high energy and adrenaline, all this stuff, and kind of being stupid things. But anyway, we started doing more and more of these caves. It was just like really cool. Eventually, in when I was 15 years old, we'd been doing a number of caves, and I had, for my biology class, proposed, which is a pretty neat project, tagging bats in the front of this little cave called Goss Cave and watching their migratory patterns during their hibernation period and where they would move around in the cave. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But and so I got all these bands, and we went and tagged all these poor little bats, not telling how many we hurt. But it was like a really great concept and stuff. And this lady came in, and she was doing, I think, not her practicum, but she was doing something where she was teaching there. And it turned out that her name was Carol Robertson. And she said, "You need to meet my brother and his group, the Indiana Speological Survey. His name's Gary Robertson." Huh. And I'm going, wow, there's actually caving clubs. And it's like, we went to Indiana University for our first meeting. And there we were. And here were all these people. And I mean, it was just like, all they do is cave. They've got a club and they're caving all the time. And they've got all these nicknames. There's the dog, and there's Dar, and there's Hergear, and there's the bear, and Ashcan, and I mean, you know, Fig. And I mean, it's like, and they talk about all these great adventures and all this cave we found in this cave, this one big cave, Binkley's Cave.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my gosh, these guys, they're having real adventures. I mean, you know, and that's what we were really into. It was like the adventure and the excitement, you know, the exploring the unknown, you know. So far, I mean, when we go in Wyandotte and those other caves, it's like, well, I wonder what's beyond there. I wonder what's that. You know, it's like we didn't know how to figure out what had been explored and what hadn't, and if something had been found new or not. It was all new to us, and we were having a blast. But it was like all of a sudden the idea was, we can take you places where no human being has been.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there going, oh my God. I mean, this is like, you know, expeditions to the North Pole, you know, with or something like that, or the jungles of the Amazon.
Yeah.
But it's right here in the backyard.
It's right there.
It's right here. It's under my feet. So we started doing a few little things with them at first, and we got our nicknames, and mine was one that did not age really well. I was called the boy.
The boy.
So they find a hole and they say, send the boy in.
The boy.
Send the boy in. Where's the boy? Bring the boy over.
Anybody still call you the boy?
Well.
Gary still call you the boy?
Just jokingly. I've kind of aged out that. Later on when I started digging more, Tim Pride kind of coined the phrase, ran the hammer, hazelnut, or something like that, because I would hammer incessantly at rock. Yeah, it seems more age appropriate at
sure.
least. But yeah, I did have a email for a long time that was Binkley Boy.
Oh, okay.
so I do use it on occasion, but yeah. But that's for somebody else next.
This was carbide caving, of course, and you could get your carbide at the hardware store there.
Well,
right?
We did. Yes, and before carbide, we used some Coleman lanterns because that's what they had in Wyandotte, and you know, D cell batteries. But yes. So one of the first things they did to us was take us to Lehman Davis Hardware Store to meet Louis Lehman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which, being a CIG guy, you know, the Caver of the Year Award is named after Louis Lehman. But yeah. Lehman Davis Hardware was the repository of all the caving knowledge of not just Southern Indiana, but big chunk of Indiana. And Louis Lehman, I mean, was bigger than life, you know. And for me, there are carbide lights in the windows, you know, there's butterflies and there's premieres. Don't buy the butterflies because they might blow up. The premieres are better light. They're more expensive. So instead of $12, you're going to spend $18. But, you know, but you could get everything for the tips and the felts for the carbide lamps and all that. And so we were getting old construction helmets and cutting them up and wiring harnesses on them so that, and, you know, we could stick a carbide lamp on them. And, you know, we felt really badass when we got our carbide lamps, you know. We were one of the crew then. But that whole experience to have gotten to go into Louis Lehman's hardware store, meet him, see that, that was a piece of history that was definitely waning, passing, going quickly. I just caught it.
Yeah. So when I read Gary's book, 50 Years, 50 Years Under the Sinkhole Plane, I don't know if the NSS bookstore has it or if Spelio Books has it, but anyway.
Well, you can certainly get it from him and his
site. Get it from him, and if you come to Indiana Caverns, I think you can buy it there.
Sale there, yeah.
But I read about that, and it just seemed like, I mean, yeah, bygone era, but still just cool to read about this community that all kind of came together at that hardware store and went caving in Binkley.
It was the focus. On the sign outside was, you know, cave information, it said, and it had his NSS number posted out there right on the sign hanging out there. Yeah. I mean, it was cool. I didn't really understand what an NSS number was there for a while. I mean, the understanding what the National Speleological Society was kind of came later on in life because I could go caving. You know, I mean, I had a group to go caving with, you know, and they all talked about it, but, you know, that cost more money. I didn't have a lot of money, but I could go caving for virtually nothing.
Yeah. So, did the first Binkley trip come soon after that?
The one that I really remember the most was that, so I guess we probably started doing some stuff with them in October, and we did some things more running around, but as far as actually going in Binkley Cave for a survey trip would have been that Christmas Eve of 77, 78. So we went in Christmas Eve and came out New Year's Day, as it were. So I was 15 years old.
You mean Christmas Day? You weren't
I'm
in
sorry,
there for
New
a week.
Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. Gotcha.
Right, right. So at 15 years old, I'm going in New Year's Eve to survey, leading my own survey trip because I'm going to be split off from them and do my first survey trip on New Year's Eve in 1977.
Did you have a watch on? Did you count down?
you know, I didn't really. But actually worked in an area that had been discovered previously called White Christmas Dome. So here we are. We went in the Bell's entrance, which were these 50-gallon drums welded together through this big talus of really nasty, crumbly rock. And it was so cold that night, and the air ripping through those drums. I mean, you touch the walls of the drum, and your gloves would stick to them.
Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, once again, we didn't have, you know, we had carbide lamps, and we had jeans and,
so you're,
you know,
in cotton.
Cotton, long underwear.
Soaked.
Yeah, it's completely soaked, because we're going up this, what they call the Virgin River, and they had inflatable rafts to help hang on to, you know, help keep you out of the water. But you were soaking wet. I mean, but, you know, we were so excited. Enthusiasm was so high. You know, I don't really remember being cold, even though I know it was freezing my ass until I got out of the cave. But I remember getting back there, and they taught me how to use this Brunton compass. You know, it's not the regular compass. It's one where you had to turn it and use the reflector and line it up and get the light. And then we had a reel tape and stuff. And, I mean, it was like, I can actually, in the database, go back and look at my survey notes now. It's a little embarrassing because I see I got a couple of bearings 180 out. but we fixed it. Long story short is I got some Virgin Cave, and I had my first survey trip there at 15 years of age. And went in 1977 and came out in 1978.
And then it was over. And then it was over for
then,
you.
Then, yeah, then I was ate up.
Okay, so then other caves came too, but Binkley's kind of been a pretty big focus of your caving life. But you got to survey some of the caves at Spring Mill State Park?
Yes, that was part of the ISS project too, was that they were charged to actually do some survey of the park for the first time of the caves.
And for people who aren't familiar, Spring Mill State Park is this great state park in Indiana. There's caves there. There's a giant, like, picturesque what anyone who even knows what a cave is would picture as a giant, cool cave entrance.
It is. You know, it is. So Donaldson.
Donaldson, yep. Cave. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's Twin and all the other caves there. Just a very karst part of the state, for sure.
Yes, and I ended up going up there several times, and we did survey in through the Donaldson entrance and went into Twin Cave and did a radio location, in fact, even in Twin Cave.
Wow.
So at, you know, like 15, 16 years old, I'm going with these older guys. My parents are letting me. And I'm camping out with them up at Spring Mill Park, you know, and we're going in the cave the next day. I got to go with some great cavers. One caver in particular was Pete Cresselius. He was part of the Indiana Speological Survey, and he went on to do some amazing cave work in Roppel Cave and the Mammoth Cave System. But, you know, just to get exposed to these people, hear their stories, and it was just like, you know, it was like lightning in a bottle.
So then, was that data that you got at Spring Mill, I mean, you had to turn that into the state or anything like that?
Well, the guy who was kind of the de facto president of the Indiana Speological Survey was the dog, Terry the Dog Creighton.
Terry.
And then Gary was kind of second, I would guess, of that, and Richard Fig Newton. And, you know, they were all kind of the main guys in it. But Dog would draft out the maps. And so he kept a copy of that. And I guess he shared it with the state, too. But, you know, once again, they were hand, you know, drawing all those maps back them and plotting them out.
Yeah,
there was a cave rescue later on, and he took his map up trying to let them know where the radio location was, where they could dig in, and some other friends I know got involved in on that too. But
was,
yeah,
that the rescue thing in the 80s where the guy was on the shelf?
Yes,
after,
exactly,
the big rain event?
Exactly. And so Tony Akers ended up being involved, Don Paquette and all them went in, yeah, there after all that. But yeah, so Dog, Terry the Dog, he was going up there and trying to tell them, if they can't get him, that they could drill right here. It's only 15 feet to get into the cave if they went to that point. So it was cool to get to do that, have access to Spring Mill Cave. I mean, that was something not just anybody had.
Yeah, you couldn't just go in there.
No, not the way we did.
So there's a cave down there that all Indiana cavers who have been doing it for a while really want to see, but we can't because of conservation reasons. Jug Hole. Mm-hmm. And you know, I get it, and it's fine, but this it's just this beautiful cave. So you've done some stuff with regard to Jug Hole?
My very first pit that I ever did was Jug Hole.
You were ruined forever then.
I was.
it was
really, really awesome. It was great. And I have to say that was my first and my best pit experience right there for many, 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 many years. It is the most picturesque pit just about there is. But after that, I thought, oh, well, this is cool. So I'm going to try some more vertical cave. And so, but we didn't have a lot of gear amongst us. And so ended up getting talked and going to Parker's pit. Got down it. We were using figure eights to go down about 100-foot pit.
I'm not familiar with Parker's pit. About 100 feet?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It was advertised, I think, at 102, but I think it's more like 97. But there's actually midway down, or a third of the way down, if you swing over, there's a big chunk of cave associated. But we were just doing the pit, and I kind of went along with a couple of friends, Doug Hanker and Paul Barker, and maybe a couple other folks. But we had one set of equipment, one rope, and I really hadn't climbed that much. I'd used Jumars in the other cave, but here we were using a gib and a couple of prusiks.
Yeah.
And it's like, I got down the bottom, and it's like, you know, hey, this stuff doesn't really fit me.
Oh, no.
And I'm thinking, what have I got myself into? And so anyway, I got on there, I got up, and about 10 feet off the floor, the gibs came untied from my foot. And I'm sitting there dangling on the rope. And I'm sitting there going, uh-oh.
So did it just...
This is not good. This is really, you know... But anyway, managed to get the gibs tied back on. And for some reason, they made it such a short knot, you know, and all. And it was really hard to get up. So I'm just trying to bust my butt just to get out there. And I get about two-thirds of the way up, and all of a sudden, a bunch of bats start flying around me. And I'm just going, my God. This is stupid. This isn't fun. This is just ridiculous. Why am I doing this? You know, here I am. I about killed myself. All I've done is gone down a hole and come back out. You know, I got myself out of there safely and everything. Well, as safe as can be done with what we had. But I made it. But that kind of turned me off of doing deep pits really until my 50s.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I had such a traumatic experience and, you know, I felt like most people doing pits were bopping pits, particularly around where we were. There wasn't a lot of cave. I wanted big cave. I wanted to go find miles of virgin cave. That's what I was interested in.
Vertical was just a means
vertical,
to the end.
Yes, vertical, and still is. It's always been a means just to get to the cave. It's not the end in and of itself for me.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm one of those people who likes to bounce a few pits, you know. I'll do pits, then cave or whatever, you know, but I'll go and bounce a pit. But you're, let's see, who else is to, Dick Blend said the same thing. He's like, I don't want to just bounce a pit. I want to do the cave.
Right, you know? Right. Well, and I certainly do enjoy doing a classic, particularly now at this point in time.
Sure, of course.
It's different, but yeah, still my focus generally, it's just another tool to get through the cave.
Ted's Dig, which is one that I've been wanting to see.
I highly recommend it. So one of the other things that went along with being a caver and being a swimmer was I was an absolute complete wild ass. I mean, totally out of control, you know, drinking, smoking, partying, you know, just wild as can be. And so, you know, here I've gotten into my 20s now and I'm, about 26 and we're doing some regular caving still. Not a lot in Binkley's right now because the other ISS Original Vanguard, they've kind of doing other stuff. They're running Marengo Cave, got their jobs, they got families, been log cabins. It's really hard to get Binkley's trips, so we're out doing stuff. And so once again, New Year's Eve, went out, and New Year's Day, had a big party, got up hungover, went to Ted's Dig, got up.
Ted is Ted Wilson?
Ted Wilson, yes. So, fabulous caver. He truly was. Boy, if you could get a hold of Nadine now and talk to him, it would be fabulous.
Yeah.
Ted was an amazing caver, did fabulous work.
Mm-hmm.
So I had just gotten I just got my third DWI.
Oh, man.
Like a couple months before. And I was just out of control. I'd been thinking about, I need to really change my life. And so we got out of the cave. I cracked the PBR and lit. For some reason, I used the beer can to light off a bottle rocket. And it shot off and, you know, yay, rah, rah, boom, report, you know. And I took a drink and it had all the smoke in it from the bottle rocket. I'm going, this is really nasty. This is the last beer I'm ever drinking. And it was.
Was it?
Yeah. So I never. Outside of Ted's Dig. You know, it was once again a milestone in my life. I made a decision not to do something, but to not do something.
Wow.
And it's something I've never regretted. I don't mind that people do it or whatever, but
sure.
It was a really smart decision for me. And it's, once again, related to caves and making, you know, a life-changing decision right then and there.
Yeah. I've heard wonderful things about Ted's Dig. And of course, I've read all about Nadine's accomplishments in the world of Indiana caving. Just
well,
amazing.
And beyond, and Tag and Ellison's. And
oh, yeah.
Everywhere.
Not to mention that, too.
And one of the first people that really brought microblasting to the area here, you know, really taught that to a lot of us.
Ted's Dig wouldn't have been possible without it, or?
Ted's Dig was more, they used actually conventional explosives there. Mm. I mean, conventional explosives have always been a part of caving, whether or not you like it. But but Nadine learned how to do, you know, more what we call microshaving, microblasting, that kind of stuff, and brought that back. I think she learned it in Virginia, West Virginia, I want to say, and brought that back to us here.
So cool. All right. So then, I mean, you worked at Wyandotte too?
Well, I did. So to kind of go along with that big change in life all of a sudden. So I didn't drink there for about a year and I kind of changed a bunch of life's habits and I finished up graduate school, a master in fine arts, concentration in pottery and ceramics. And and I was interested in wood fired Japanese ceramics and
one of your professions to this day, right?
One of many. One of many.
I don't want to single one out, but is one.
Whatever you got to do, right? Well, it was certainly something I was, once again, much like caving, I was trying to find something that really excited me and thrilled me. So anyway, I got married. And I married a woman who was older than me, already had four kids. And I just fell in love with the kids. But it also meant that I needed to work a whole lot more. So I was working three jobs. And so I was working for a nonprofit, working with people with disabilities during the day. And then I was a jail officer working second shift. And then on the weekends, I was a tour guide at Wyandotte Cave.
Wow, you're stretched pretty thin.
I worked 7 days a week for 2 years without a single day off.
Jeez.
But, you know, that was part of, you know, my maturation process,
sure,
to kind of go where I felt like I needed to go at the time. It really helped me get my head on straight. But those times in Wyandotte Cave were fabulous. Not only did I get to be a tour guide, but I got turned loose in the cave after hours.
Back then,
we got to go in the cave and go explore and had
Wyandotte.
Some fabulous times. Yes, yes.
And the thing, if you're listening to this and you don't know what Wyandotte is, the thing you got to know about Wyandotte is it's this Indiana cave, and it's not the biggest cave in Indiana, obviously, but it is grand. Like, you go in there, and it's grand, not just in the size of the rooms, but also in the history, and not just modern history, but prehistoric history as well.
It's kind of the Carlsbad of Indiana in a lot of ways, you know. I got to go places where there were actually torch braids still on the floor left there from mid-1800s explorers, if not Indians themselves. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting was that I started doing some stuff with Dave Black and Holly Cook and some things at that point in time, and took me back an area in this place called Teasing Wind, which turned out to be part of the Danny Dyable groups and their digs, where they were sneaking in through Easter Pit and doing some things back in there. So here's
flash bulb crawl or whatever.
Yeah, that whole thing. Yeah, I think all of that. But some beautiful gypsum flowers down in some of the areas and stuff and all, and went through that Teasing Wind dig and was like, oh my God. You know, so I'm saying, wow, this is real exploring again, you know. And so once again, we're out there running all over the ridge in between tours and looking for more cave, and so it just get more on fire with it, you know, even trying to raise a family and trying to be responsible. Still can't get this caving thing out of my head. So
working every day and still finding time for caving. Wow.
Well,
you do what you do, I guess.
What drives you can't stop.
No. The Harrison County Grotto's not around anymore, right?
No, but that was Dave Black. I think he put that together, HCG, Harrison County Grotto. And I took my kids to a couple of things that were going on and events that they would have annually. And Dave put together a really nice guidebook. And right about that time, I bought 100 acres in Harrison County, too. I had had a little piece of property that I inherited from my grandmother, and I had this little sports car. And I sold my piece of property in Floyd County and the sports car to be able to buy this 100 acres, well, to put a down payment, to make payments on this 100 acres in Harrison County, which had caves on it.
Ooh,
and literally 5 minutes from Binkley's. I mean, I can see a Binkley's entrance almost from the backside of my property.
Oh.
So it was just like a dream come true, because I had to have water, cliffs, and caves on the property that I bought, and it had it all.
You had it all.
Right, right.
Are you right on the Blue?
I'm right on Big Indian Creek.
Okay.
So,
which goes
not
to the
far.
Blue.
Well, it
not
does
quite.
Through Binkley's. Actually, the sinks of Indian Creek drain out into Harrison Springs, which goes into Blue River.
Oh.
So it's one of the only crossings that go underneath a water way and then come back out into it. So, but that's connected. That's part of the Binkley Cave system, too. That's just how big that thing is.
Jeez.
It's huge.
All right. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah.
So then you're in your early 30s.
Yep.
There's kind of is there an incident that brings about?
Well, there's a number of things going on. Obviously, you know, I'm doing the kids and stuff and all, but I'm going to a concert and I have a big chest pressure and pain and stuff, and I think I'm having a heart attack. And they go in and they put a Holter monitor on me, and they actually find out that my heart's stopping when I sleep at night. It's going down to 18 beats a minute and pausing for 9 seconds at a time.
Did you have any indication of that? Like, did you wake up feeling crappy or anything like that?
No, actually what I went in for turned out to be upper GI problems, you know. They found this by accident when they put the 24-hour monitor on, and it turns out my type of rhythm disorder was really rare because it's neurologically based.
Mm.
And it was, you know, my heart started up every night, but it didn't but they were afraid it might not. And so they were like, you know, I saw 7 different heart specialists. Only 2 people had ever seen the type of rhythm issue that I'd had at that time. And I said, well, you know, I really don't want a pacemaker because I found this out at 30. And so I waited and I tried to have this monitor. It was an apnea monitor I'd sleep with and turn it off. But she had to wear sticky things at night. It was not conducive for an intimate personal life or for any real existence. And then.
And you can't roll over and sleep on your belly.
It's just a real pain all the way. And then I felt like, you know, well, this isn't really good for my relationship or fair to my wife. And so I thought, well, if my heart for some reason instead of doing it at night did during the day, you know, I'm driving a car, I could hurt somebody. So I decided to get a pacemaker. In the middle of it, they accidentally stopped my heart. I had a near-death experience.
Oh my gosh.
It was an incredible experience. So that's a whole nother thing. But I came out of that. I wasn't afraid of dying anymore, but I was certainly more enthusiastic about doing things that were important to me.
And about living, as it were.
Yes, yes, yeah. So it was kind of, you know, once again, one of those readjustments in life that occur.
The 100 acres that you bought, to go back to that,
yeah.
That's where you still are?
Mm-hmm. Yes, to this day. I move in an old 1830s log cabin up on top of my stack of sticks, as I call it. And it's got a cave that's right over the bluff. It's right on the edge of the bluff, and I'm looking at 30,000 acres of state forest, 150-foot cars, Ted. And there's a cave right underneath the cabin. It blows 60-foot plume of steam. There's all sorts of holes in there. I've dug open another 40-foot pit. Just within 15 minutes walking distance, there's about 6 different caves, and Binkley's Cave is a 5-minute drive. So, you know, it's just about as perfect a piece of property for a caver as you could hope for in Indiana.
Yeah.
And so I've had a lot of great times on there, and all those holes on the property, they're my retirement digs.
Yeah.
So, okay. If I ever get around to that. So.
Well, when you say it all like that, I mean, it all sounds pretty fantastic.
Well, it is. You know, my goal was to actually live a vacation.
So, well, I'd
so
say...
I wanted to live where everybody else would want to go and have a vacation.
Oh.
I love people, but I want them on my terms. And, you know, I can see anybody that's coming up my driveway. You know, my driveway is over a half a mile long, and so I'm up on this karst outcropping here. And so if somebody starts to pull in, I'm deaf as a doorknob, but I can still hear that gravel clicking underneath the wheels. And I can see anybody coming up. So, but it's beautiful.
All right. So let's get into Binkley.
Yeah.
Or do you want to talk about Hogfest?
Well, one of the important things about that property was, you know, the Harrison Crawford County Grotto was looking for a more permanent place to have their annual event, Hogfest, which
it
became Hogfest because HCG looked like HCG. HOG on their signs. And so it got this name Hogfest. And
I had no idea.
So yeah, it was at Stage Stop and it was other places like that over the years. But for like about 6 years or so, it ended up being up at my property. And we had some really nice crowds. One year we had almost 100 people there, and there was like a vendor selling cave gear and stuff, you know, and the caves were all open. So, you know, we were going and, you know, Breathing Hole and Ted's Dig and all that kind of stuff. And everybody was bouncing pits. And it was really great because I didn't, with the kids and everything and all, I didn't have the time to go do the caving. So the caving was coming to me.
Oh.
And it was great, you know. And so I was still getting my caving fixed, maybe not as much as I wanted, but I was still staying relevant. And I got my daughters and stuff into some small caves and things. And it was just really a great time. So that went on for about 6 years until they decided my driveway was just too big of a pain. And they went on to another location until it kind of fizzled away.
Okay, so you get into... I don't want to say back into Binkley because Binkley's probably kind of scattered throughout here, but the Millennium Dig.
Yeah, yeah. The big thing about Binkley is it's always been hard to get a group of people to continuously go into Binkley's.
Yeah, I would imagine.
It's difficult to get into, and it's a kind of a brutal cave. It's a beautiful cave and a lot there, but it takes a real commitment. And so Gary was starting to show, he was wanting to write this book. He and George Jagers had talked about it. I think it was at a convention. And he decided he was going to write what became 50 Years Under Sinkhole Plain.
Mm-hmm.
We started going in and picking up survey, and he was showing me places that he thought were leads that we needed to know. And he wanted to make sure that he passed on information to me of how to get to certain places, because there wasn't anybody else. I was the connection between the old Vanguard and anybody that was still really interested in the project. And then entered Dave Everton coming in to take pictures for the book. And Dave got all jazzed about the cave, too. He'd been doing some stuff and some other caves. I think it was Wayne Cave. And he came up and he was really excited. Big project caver again, too. And all of a sudden, I had a playmate. Somebody else who wanted to go and make something happen in Binkley's. And that kind of started the whole Dave Everton and reinvigoration of the ISS, as it were. And it's
because there's a Dave Everton era to Binkley. You
there
know?
Is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it saw that saw a nearly doubling of the cave.
Yes, it was incredibly prolific period of time. Dave is kind of an obsessive person. Once he gets hooked his teeth into something, he doesn't let go of it until he's done with it. And Binkley's Cave certainly became that for him, and we became really close, fast friends. And we've shared some incredible time together underground and as friends, and the group of us there that developed out of that. I mean, it was truly one of those golden moments in your life where you've got a group of people and a project and it's just hitting on all cylinders. If you're lucky, you get one of these maybe in your life in your caving career. I've been more than lucky, but certainly this one was the big one. And when I started Binkley's at 15, it was 17 miles long. So Dave comes along and Gary's trying to get his book and he's there and Gary goes, I need about 1700 more feet to be, I think it was like 23 miles at the time or 24. And so I'm like, hey, what's over here? And what's that? And he goes, oh, that's just some nasty crawl. Nobody ever wanted to do anything like that. So he and Dave are over here looking at this passage and I go down this crawl and it's hands and knees in water and I'm going. And then I'm going, and I'm going, and it opens up, and it gets bigger, and there's more of it, and it keeps going, and it's getting bigger, and I've been away now for about 45 minutes,
Gary, this
and
is more I'm than turning a little around
back, and so I get back to him, hey, Gary, I found your 1,700 feet, probably a little more, and so this turned out to be Cavefish Crawl, and I think this was kind of the dynamite that helped to set Dave going, there's stuff here all over the place, that people haven't really looked at. And certainly each generation with the advent of better thermal underwear, better lights, different, mining technologies, it opens up all sorts of different doors and opportunities. And we had a whole bunch of those all of a sudden in our hands.
Wow.
And tons of cave. So that kind of jump-started that whole thing.
So about when was that?
2009.
All right. I thought that was when, right. About when Dave took over that part.
So after Hogfest and all that, there really wasn't a lot of Binkley activity until the late 90s. And then all of a sudden, there was a lot of interest in the Millennium Dig. Mm. In 98 and 99, there were, I think, around 20-some-odd dig trips back into this Millennium area, which was not very far from the historic entrance. So it was really great. You could go and dig through the week of an evening and get some digging done, as well as, on a weekend trip. But I mean, it was, going in and taking, once again, we were using more kind of makeshift, conventional, chemical persuasion.
Thereabout, yeah.
Right, because we didn't have the drills yet and stuff that we have now. The battery-operated drills, they just didn't exist yet. And so we were making do with what we had. The dog, he would set off these blasts, and we're mining through a breakdown pile. The air is just running through it, and we've got a bunch of people in these crawls passing bags of rock back through. And it's a lot of the old Vanguard back there again, John Benton was there, and Fig Newton was there, and Gary was there, and the dog was there.
It's like, if anything's going to happen in my cave, I'm going to be there for
it. That's right. Well, and the dog was hot on it. And when the dog was hot on something, he was going to get through. But I mean, we're talking, it's just all breakdown over the top of us. So he'd set off a charge and he made this thing called the claw, which was basically a big piece of rebar that then he welded fingers on. And so he would set off a charge and then go up and he'd poke up in the ceiling and start pulling rocks down. And I mean, I was right behind him and it would just rain rocks, just rain. And then he'd take a hammer and you'd see him sweating as he's beating these rocks apart and passing them on back and coming through. And he'd do it again and it'd rain rocks and he'd pass it back. back and stuff. And I mean, you know, the dog's only about 5'4" tall. So, I mean, but he's as mighty as a mountain.
Well, that's caver. That's caver
right,
for
right.
you.
I mean, but the biggest curmudgeon, you know, a true character. But anyway, the things that I watched that man do truly inspired me. And, he eventually got down through this place and under what they called the soapstone boulder, which we had to mine. So we went up and over and then down under this boulder, and then we popped back up into another breakdown pile, and we started bust around in there, and he set off one last big charge of explosives. And so this would have been towards the end of 99, and all of a sudden we were in. And the room was off. It was a big room that we kind of come out into, and then there was a stream taking off of it. But we called it the Foggy Mountain Room because of all the dynamite fumes that were rolling around in it. We ended up surveying about a mile of cave in the Millennium stream that way.
Wow.
And so, and that Foggy Mountain Room later on became important as the next generation of ISS work Dewey Eckert Pit. So, but it all kind of ties back in.
Okay, so that's where Dewey connects.
Dewey ultimately connects back into the Foggy Mountain Room from its original entrance.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was really cool. That was kind of, you know, an Odyssey kind of loop again for me, you know, where that we came back home to the Foggy Mountain Room.
Oh. And there's a passage near there named after you?
Well, at the back of the Millennium, you know, once again, send the boy in kind of thing. You know?
Okay.
Even though I wasn't the boy, I was still kind of the youngest one there out of the group because, you know, that was just what it was. Everybody's, you know, 14, 15 years older than me. And so it's like, so here was this passage and they sent me in, and I mean, it's just a slime hole, nasty thing.
Yeah.
And went up and crawled around and stuff and all. But, you know, I got several feet of virgin cave and looked like there had a potential for maybe do something a little more. But it was nasty as hell. And I came out and I was freezing cold and completely slimed out. And so on the back of Gary's cover of his book is me holding what appears to be a Snickers bar covered in mud, because it was a Snickers bar covered in mud, and I'm trying to eat it to stop shaking enough that I can get the hell out of the cave. But so they were nice enough to name the passage after me and call it Rand's Passage. So that was my first real claim to fame in the Binkley's cave system as far as having something named after me.
Oh my gosh.
So in the midst of all this, while I'm doing my caving, you know, I'm still working another job, working nonprofit administration, management and stuff, particularly people with disabilities and stuff and all, and really doing well in that career. But I'm also working on my art career because that's what my master's is.
Yeah.
You know, so I've got a big studio going on. I'm actually working well with one of the top 10 ceramic artists in the country, and we share a studio together, and I'm doing shows and competitions. I've gotten into the number one competitive art show in the world twice, based out of New Zealand, and I'm getting in some galleries and some collections and stuff throughout. So I'm really making a name for myself.
Awesome.
And so Byron was his name, the guy I shared my studio with, and quite a piece of work and curmudgeon himself. But he was also very practical, and he goes, Rand, you cannot be a world class potter and a world class caver too. You must choose. And I'm sitting here going,
wait a minute,
why?
I disagree. With that.
Why?
But okay.
And I'm sitting there going, all right, well, man, you know, I put all this money in education trying to do this and stuff. And, you know, this has been kind of what I've been working towards. And caving's always been fun, you know, and it's, you know, a way to make a life out of it. So anyway, I started putting more energy into my pottery. And I still cave, but not as much there for a while. And right after the Millennium, not too long after that, we had 9/11 and all of that happened, and life kind of changed again. I left my first marriage, and I was working for another organization, and I was high up in that organization while I'm still trying to pursue my pottery career, and that kind of panned out. You know, all of a sudden, those programs I was in charge of, they got defunded. Mm. And so it's like, I got laid off. And so I'm going, okay, well, is this a bad thing or is this an opportunity? And I said, okay, this is the time now to go take my ceramics and see what can happen. So I opened up a school, a gallery, and a clay and chemical equipment store in Louisville, Kentucky. And so for the next several years, I ran this operation in Louisville on Frankfort Avenue. And it was very successful until the recession. And then all of a sudden, all the disposable income went away. And so I'd had a piece of property that had gone up in value, like tripled. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't even sell it. Mm. And life got really, really tough. And I pretty much got over my pottery in a lot of way. I had just was getting ready to sell my store. I was trying to open up a workshop center and all that kind of stuff. And it was just done almost in a matter of days.
Gosh.
And I went from having 7 exhibitions and an international, I was juring a number of international shows and regional shows and stuff. And it was just over.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's hard.
So yeah, it was really hard, and there was no way for me to maintain that property and keep my home, and had to make some hard decisions, and it took its toll on me.
Yeah.
It really, really did. I was kind of lost there for a little bit, and that's about the same time that started caving more again. Then the Everton thing happened there,
yeah.
Gary's book, and all of a sudden it brought back purpose to my life.
Right.
And it was, you know, I felt like I had something I loved to do again, because I felt like that had been taken away and stripped away from me. So once again, here's caves coming in and playing a role as far as refocusing me on what's important. You get in the cave, everything else goes away.
It has to.
It does. You have to focus, be in the moment, be right there, right then. The people that you're with, you have to trust.
Mm-hmm.
They've got your back. I mean, it's the closest thing to like what we always said, a military kind of experience, you know, where the person really behind you has your life in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And many, many situations we've been that where it's not tourist. When you're doing, you know, this kind of, you know, original exploration, that's very much the case. You're trusting the person behind you or in front of you have your back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we had. And there was a comfort to that that came like nothing else. And mm-hmm. it builds bonds and also a personal self-assurance that you can't get any other way, and a personal peace. When you're pushing something that's your own personal limits, not because somebody's forcing you to do it, but because you're up there and you're saying, all right, can I not do this because I physically can't do it, or is it in my head? And then all of a sudden you start realizing that those boundaries kind of keep moving further back, and that really you can do this, and you can push this, or you can make this happen, and you figure out ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden you start applying that when you come out of the cave of the real world, and it's like, I can do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I can handle this.
Yeah.
The world's a whole lot easier. And finding lots of virgin cave makes everything better.
Well, I think that a good message here for cavers, if you're going down, if parts of your life are going down, there's always caving.
It is. Caving saved my life. I can tell you, I was not in a good place. I was in a bad headspace. If it were not for caving, I'm not sure I would be here today. Certainly not in the way that I am, and happy the way I am now.
Mm. That's something else. All right. Well, so caving comes back, and then we've already talked about the Dave Everton thing and taking pictures for the book. And
right. So that was really the unveiling of a whole new regime.
Yeah.
And we worked really well together. I mean, we were just as much cave as we could survey in a day. We were surveying over and over and over again, whether it was in Blowing Hole or Guy Stover or, you know, Miller Cave, or, you know, one of the different ones. You know, we were just finding cave on top of cave and connecting cave systems back into the main cave system. And then it kind of changed again. So in the middle of all this activity, Gary comes to me and he goes, Gary Robertson had sold his share of Marengo Cave, but he had an agreement where he couldn't compete for a number of years.
Mm.
But he always had this dream of building a show cave out of Binkley's.
Yeah.
And so he had me going in with the dog on some other trips through the weeks, looking at other places where he might develop a show cave out of Binkley's. And they were trying to do it around the mountain room where you've been and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't work out. And he was about to give up. And there'd just been a big discovery of this area called Big Bone Mountain, which was off of the Guy Stover connection and the Scaling Pole area that we'd gotten into. And Shane Miles and Tim Pride had kind of really found this area.
So let me stop you right there. Mm-hmm. So let me get some general thoughts on developing Binkley as a show cave.
Right.
So before that was found in the area that's now Indiana Caverns, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously Gary's Gary, and you don't want to say, I don't think this is a good idea. But did you ever have the thought in your mind that, like, Gary, what are you doing? Binkley as a show cave?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, it's like, well, there's not really a lot of great places to it. It's really crappy rock. There's not a huge amount of formations, and it's not easy to get to. And on top of that, it's kind of like, do I really want Binkley's to be a show cave? You know, that there was that piece of it, too, that was in my head.
Okay, all right.
That's So I had that, too. It's like, you know, do I really want this commercialized? But anyway, Gary's genuine friend, and I got to thinking when I saw this room. I wasn't there on the first day that we got into it, but I went on the very next trip to survey this. And mind you, this is a really cool area. We bust into this big room after going through this big trunk passage that we were calling Blowing Hole Boulevard at the time. And we climb up in this big room, and it's all about 350 feet long and 75 feet wide or something like
big
that.
Room.
It's a big room, yeah, and it's kind of got a couple of levels to it. You know, it looks like it's had a higher level that's collapsed into a lower level and stuff. And really, really neat area. But there were bones all over the place.
Wow.
And there was, I mean, this guy, you know, we were looking over and goes, oh, that's a cow skeleton. It's fallen in a sinkhole or something up there. I'm going, that's no cow skeleton.
And
we took it.
Where's the sinkhole?
Right. Well, there are some holes over the top where you could see that maybe something could have at one point in time.
Sure.
Come over because, you know, agriculture closes things up over the cave all
that's
the time.
That's true. Okay.
We run into that all the time. We lose entrances. But anyway, got one of the teeth out of it and took it back. And Ron Richards, who was really a great resource at the time at the Indiana State Museum, he would carbon date anything for us or identify stuff. And he said, well, this is from a bison about 35, 40,000 years old. It's Pleistocene era. Well, we were finding bones all over the place. And Ron ultimately came down to the cave, and he went through it all after we were development. And he was known for McGinnity Peccary Cave and doing all the peccary work there.
Yeah.
You know what peccaries are? They're kind of...
They're like pigs.
Pigs on stilts, yeah, kind
yeah.
of thing, you know. So his big thing was, you know, mining all this. And we were finding, like, whole articulated skulls and skeleton stuff along the edges. He came in here, and he'd been there about an hour. He goes, I've been working with, you know, peccary remains for over 20 years. And in the last 2 hours, I have seen more remnants of entire animals here than I have seen in my entire career. So that tells you how significant a discovery this was.
Wow.
So anyway, to get back to the show cave part of it, Gary's just going, he's down to his last desperate thing. And I said, well, I think there might be one place you could do that. I said, this big bone mountain that we just found, I think it's got some show cave potential. And so he managed to get himself on the next trip and come back in there and take a look at it. And his eyes got as big as saucers. And he said, this is it, you know. And so helped him kind of put the land deal together, met the landowner and worked out something. And next thing you know, he's like, Rand, will you help me build the cave? And it's like, you know, wow, okay. So because I really haven't, from my art store, I haven't really gone back to another regular job. I was doing some stuff for the State Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, but that just was not working out for me. And I didn't want to work for the state at that time. And so I said, okay, yeah, I'll help you do it. And it was slave wages and everything, but I thought, this way I'll get to make sure that this is done right.
And you're a professional caver.
I am.
Like,
I am.
Legitimately,
and I have a lot, and I have a personal self-interest here.
Sure.
So anyway, I got myself roped into it. So the week before, I take a vacation, and I go to the Outer Banks, and I'm going surfing, and I get crashed into the side of the seashore. I separate my shoulder and rotator cuff and the clavicle, and I come back, and the doctor goes, that's one of the most impressive injuries I've seen. So I show up for work that Monday, one armed, and I'm operating a $750,000 Furukawa drill to try and drill the entrance into the show cave.
Oh my God.
And thus began the ordeal of the longest year of my life there in a sense, trying to get in there. We were working in 113 degree heat, setting off 2 and 3 cases of dynamite a day, trying to get through this. And it was one of the hottest summers ever. And I mean, it was just brutal.
Is this 12? Summer 12?
I believe that's correct.
That was a dry summer,
yes, it
too.
It was the driest, hottest that we that I remembered. Wow. I mean, it would rain everywhere but where we were. It was just brutal. And then it was cold on top of that. But we continued. I mean, there were many times where we'd be working. The number of near-death experiences there, I can't tell you. I remember standing there and talking to the dog, and we were bringing everything in through the drill hole that we brought in at the top. And a 50-pound bag of concrete fell just in between the middle of us. Or a big thing of formations. We went lunch. They were there. We come back and they were gone. They were at the bottom of the platform to the bottom. I mean, it was just like one thing after another. It was most brutal conditions. And I kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. I'm going, man, what is wrong? Well, it turns out my pacemaker was failing. So in the middle of this, I developed pacemaker syndrome. Didn't know what it was. I was around a lot of welding, magnetic fields. Maybe the injury, who knows what. But it was also 19 years old. It was a really old pacemaker. Mm-hmm. Insurance wouldn't pay for it at the time to replace it. And then all of a sudden, it was out. I went home. I told my wife that I was feeling really bad. She said, well, let's wait till the doctor office opens up the next day. And I did. And they said, get your ass to the emergency room. 2.5 hours later, I had a new pacemaker, and I felt like a new guy.
Oh, there you go.
Because the pacemaker was actually causing an AFib type condition. Normally, my pacemaker doesn't do anything unless I'm asleep. But then it was actually causing a problem with my heart and enlarging one side of my heart. And anyway, long story short, I got feeling better. I was off about 4 weeks, and then I came back and I finished up Indiana Caverns. Mm. I felt like a new person. We had to make some corrections. It was really hard, but we managed to get the thing open. And I felt, you know, like I'd really accomplished something, you know, getting that done, not just walking out on it. But I wasn't sure I was going to keep caving. I was so burnt being underground 5 days a week.
It's too much.
My caving, you know, had been traumatically impacted during this time. They were working on Miller Cave and trying to connect it into an upper region of Blowing Hole. And I came back and helped Tim McLean had gotten through and gotten into Blowing Hole, but couldn't get it open. So I brought the drill in because I was doing a lot of drilling and blasting for the cave. So I brought my arsenal in and we busted it open. And I ended up, even though I wasn't the first person, as was often the case with Tim and I was the second person into Blowing Hole right behind him via Miller Cave.
Okay.
And so the next week, I'm sitting here going, I'm still feeling like, yeah, this is, you know, I'm so tired of the caving thing, but I need a good survey trip or something. And so we went back to this area David found called the Black Shell Passage, and we surveyed it. And the first 1,750 feet, it's just this, you know, really low-level shale pothole passage, and you're crawling in it, and then all of a sudden it drops down into this stream, and we're talking, you know, a couple inches of airspace, ear dipper. The air is going through there, and everybody is like, they're just kind of done. We've already done 1,700 feet of survey, and they're like, you know, I don't really want to go through this, you know. And it's like, I just had this feeling that I had to give it a go. I felt like, you know, that in my mind, right then there, before I did, I said, I need to do this. So I said, all right, guys, this is mine. The air coming through there was tremendous. It was making the water ripple. There was so much air coming out of it. So I knew there was something. So I got in there, and the really bad ear dipper was right at the first part. And then it got a little bit better, and it was cobble floor. I had to keep pushing the cobble away, keep going. I mean, I'm going. The air is just tremendous, but it's not getting any bigger, and I just keep going. I keep going. I said, all right, man, if I'll just stick with this, and if it doesn't shut off, I'm going to find something. And I keep going. And what turns out to be 900 feet later,
wow,
solo push, you know, through lots of low airspace air dippers, you know, I break out into a whole nother river system. What we ended up calling the Wild Wild West and the Milky Way, and then took off to Wilson Way. It was really close to a big junction to a whole nother section of cave that we didn't even really have a clue existed. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, this whole time, I've always been accused of being what they called randiose or having illusions of randor, because I would always say, okay, the cave is so much bigger than what you all think. They said, well, it'll never go into the high ground. There's no way we'll get beyond the high ground. You know, there's a whole nother drainage divide and everything. I said, the cave goes beyond there. I'm telling you, I just know it. I can't tell you why, but this cave is just so much bigger than what you think. And they just would make the most fun of me. Well, all of a sudden, they weren't making as much fun of me anymore, because we just were all of a sudden going through the high ground.
You proved them wrong.
I did. And not only that, all of a sudden, I was excited about caving in Binkley's again.
Oh, thank goodness. Something had to come around and save it.
It did. But once again, caving saved me. Yeah. It brought me back. And then that opened up a whole new layer of exploration. Some of the biggest cave that we found, master cave systems. It also kind of marked a period of time that, you know, became very difficult, because it was not too many trips after that that Tim McLean, who was a dear, dear friend, we had such great adventures together. He and I were kind of Tim was everybody's best friend in a lot of ways. If you ask them, Tim was my best friend. Tim was my best friend. But, you know, Tim and I, we were pushers and diggers. And there were many times where we pushed and dug stuff, like Davidson Dig, got in a place there where we opened up the, we're working on it, just the two of us. I blasted something. He got through. He got on the other side, and he couldn't get out. And so
he was a master kind of pusher, squeezer guy.
He said he always got 50 feet of virgin cave every day, no matter what. And he pretty much did with just the Wonder Bar. But anyway, so I had to blast him out, and Tim McLean's going on these trips, and I see that he's already having some problems, and Laura Demarest is with us, and we're doing some stuff back in that area, and these are really getting to be long trips. I mean, we keep going, all right, how much further can we go? Mm-hmm. And we establish...
what's happening sort of in the Binkley world at this time is, this probably connects to Blowing Hole. Right? Like, this is the mindset.
We've connected Blowing Hole. This is going to something entirely unknown and new.
Okay.
We don't know. It's going off the map. We're off the edge.
Okay.
This is something.
It's a very exciting time.
Yes, very, very exciting.
Everton
time.
Was working it, and it's the talk of the community in
it
Indiana.
Is. But this is total flood area. You're not going to camp here.
Yeah.
Everything's a weekend warrior trip. You know, it's what you can do in a trip. You're not staying in there for days at a time and surveying lots of caves. So, you know, you have to traverse all of that nasty river ride and the Black Shale Shelf Passage and Miller Cave, which is a nasty cave in and of itself. You're crawling a mile one way before you start to get to the good cave.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, your hours and hours and hours, you know, 7 hours back in to get to first lead and then another lead. I mean, so once we really get in there, it's really long. But so Tim kind of started bringing in, you know, some of the isobutane stoves, and we set up a place where we could make what we call McLean Country Kitchens, where we'd actually have hot food and different things like that, so that we could actually start to do these things for longer periods. It was no longer a bottle of water and a Snickers bar.
Setting up a base of operation.
Yeah, you really had, yes, and you really had to take care of yourself and feed your body and stoke the machine so you keep going. And we also started picking up other groups. There was two parallel groups in Indiana kind of worked, that were the kind of the Binkley cavers, kind of the Sinkhole Plain cavers, and the Dibble group, which had Ted Wilson was kind of part of that too, Danny Dibble, Greg McNamara, Tony and Marion Akers, and they were doing, Dave Black did a lot with them too, but they did a lot of the vertical stuff, and they were doing Wyandotte Ridge caving, you know, and a lot of stuff in Tag. You know, I didn't get to go to Tag. I can go to Tag, and I had Binkley's right there, you know, so I was that, but all of a sudden, those people started crossing over a group as we were finding this stuff. Marion Akers was one of the first ones there. And I remember one of the first things Marion and I did was to survey through Rand's River Ride, and got about 600 feet into it. And we were at a really nasty place. And I remember turning, it was just her and I right there. And I turned to her and I said, all right, this is about as bad as it gets. If you can stand this, we're going to make it through anything else. And she just kind of laughed at me and smiled and said, all right, well, let's go. And so we did. And I have to say, we've been going and surveying ever since. So,
yeah, I guess so.
That November, July was when we found that. That November was when Tim was helping to carry dive tanks for Adam Haydock to do a dive sump into Blowing Hole. I met them for breakfast. I wasn't going on that trip because it was holidays and I needed to do some family stuff and all, but yeah. I met him. And I got a call out about 5:30 at Ruby Tuesdays from Nick Benton, my friend there. It was a text, and he said, we've got a problem. We've got a problem. Tim's down. I mean, it's just text. And you know, he's had a heart attack, it looks like. And, you know, they're trying to resuscitate him. And, you know, so obviously he's been away from Tim. Now, if he's come out from where they were, that's been like a couple of hours ago since he's gotten out. So, Nick, are we talking about a body recovery? And I got one word back, basically. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, my God. You know, this is one of my best buds. So, I mean,
but at the same time, you're kind of going into this mode.
Right, right.
You know, recovery mode.
Right.
Helping my friends get my other friend out.
So they're saying, you know, you need to get over here as quick as you can. We need to send, you know, a quick team in there to go and see what's going on, because there's cavers still in there. You know, it's not just Tim. Now it's the cavers that are with Tim. Yeah. And I'm one of the few people that know how to get back where they are in Blowing Hole. So I get there and Anmar is there, you know, and they're putting in Don Paquette, and they're putting all the rescue and stuff together. And so they're suiting me up and, you know, and sending me in. So I and Ryan Cox go in, and we've got a skid and the body bags and everything and stuff and all. And Dave is there. He's over in the house. And I don't think he realized the state he was in, but I could tell that he was in shock. I mean, as you would expect. And it was a pretty good group of people, and I can't even recall who all was on it at the time. But he was in the house there, and he was just kind of like, he wasn't quite there. I mean, it was like, for what had happened, he was incredibly detached.
Who can blame him?
Right. No, there's no blame here. So I knew, wow. So here we are. And so I head into the cave with Ryan Cox and I, and Adam Haydock's leading us back to where the body was, or to where Tim was. And we get there, and there's Laura Demarest right over the top of him. He got lame on the side. And Laura, we're trying to resuscitate him for probably an hour or so. Jeez. I mean, you know, and she's just devastated. And then here are some other friends of mine over there too. You know, there's four other people. I mean, there's Chris Parks there and April McKay, I think. And, you know, there were several people there. And it's like, all right, Laura, hun, you just got to go. You got to get out of here. I mean, and she's obviously devastated. She and Tim were incredibly close. Tim brought her in to the group, you know. And so she was really the first new female Binkley caver in the group. And she had been coming since the earlier Blowing Hole stuff. And, you know, this was her best friend too. And anyway, we had to send Laura off. I said, you need to go. You need to take care of yourself and get out of here. And so then I and Ryan Cox proceeded to place in a body bag my best friend, Tim McLean. I mean, I remember looking down at him and, you know, his lips blue and cold. And, you know, in a place that we'd had such amazing times together. And, you know, and I'm, you know, fighting this thing, you know, it's like, well, what more appropriate location for this to happen? You know, he would have loved this. And at the same time, you know, the selfish response of being, well, what am I going to do now? Yeah. You know, what we're going to do without you? And so anyway, we got him there, and Ryan and I are sitting there waiting. And then some of the other current ISS group show up, you know, and I think it was Shane Miles and Tim Pride and Brad Barkham. And we started to take his body out. We had a sked, and we'd wrap the body bags up and put it in the sked, and we started taking him on out. And we went about a mile in the cave before we met the next group of people, which was Ty Spada was there, and I'm trying to remember who else was Ty, and we got him down through the waterfall area. And it was kind of like the whole time we're going out, we're telling Tim stories. It was kind of like, you know, and so here's Tim in this orange sked. He's just kind of floating in the water there. And it was kind of like, we described it kind of like a Viking funeral already. It was kind of awake. I mean, it was like, as upset and bummed as we were, all we could do was talk about Tim and the amazing times that we had with Tim as we're taking him out. I mean, you know, when there's this kind of, you know, disconnect that's happening to emotionally, you know.
You have to disassociate somehow. Right, right. I mean, you got a job to do. You're
right.
Probably half in shock, too.
Sure,
what else are you going to do?
Sure. So, yeah, we're kind of in our own survival mode. You know, we're getting a safe place mentally as best we can. And we get him out, and then all of a sudden we get the other side of the waterfall and get past there, and there's Anmar there with them laying line, calm line. He sees we got the body, you know, and everything. And so he runs ahead, and then we get, about a quarter of a mile from the entrance there. And then we start encountering the large groups of people, you know, rescuers and stuff and all. And of course, they're all fighting to take his body away from us at that time. It's kind of like, we don't want to let go of it. But at some point, it's just kind of like we have to hand it off and leave him and walk out. And from that moment on, that was all different.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, that was really the end of it. For me, it was a reevaluation of things and a time to double down. It was like, you know, the last thing Tim would want was for any of us to quit caving because he had a heart attack that he was going to have anyway. The coroner told me, and I was already working for the county at this time and everything, and I knew the coroner, and he said, look, Tim had this heart attack in emergency room, he'd still probably be dead. You know, he had an aneurysm. He was gone before he hit the ground. And from everything I heard, that's exactly what happened. I mean, there was no way Tim was going to survive what had happened.
Wow.
It was almost inevitable.
Okay.
So it's like, all right, well, then I guess this, everybody was okay. We need to keep going. And so we ended up going back to the McLean. And all of a sudden, we kept getting further and further out. People were kind of scared. You know, we lost Tim. And then now here we are really far out. I think Dave was already, I think, you know, he was coming down 50 out of 52 weekends a year for, you know, 4 or 5 years now. So he was obviously, I mean, any person would be starting to get burned out a little bit.
It was a lot for a long time.
And his music interest was growing. I mean, he loved music, and he was playing more and more with his bands. And Dave and I are of the same mindset that it's like, how could anybody ever be bored in life? There's so many things to get excited about.
Yep.
Yes, I love caving, but if I could never cave tomorrow, I would still find something else to get excited about.
It's funny you say that, because I went caving with Dave just this past weekend, mm-hmm. and I rode with him, and it was just me and him, and we had the same conversation.
Right.
There's so much to be excited about.
There is. But caving is certainly very, very special, and I'm not going to give it up until I have to.
Sure.
And neither is Dave, obviously.
Yeah.
Dave's just caving in a different way. But, you know, everything kind of has its life, and I don't mean just Tim's life, but I mean a project or, you know, something that you do before you change what you do for whatever reason, whether it's interest or capability or you know, anything. And I think that for a number of people, Tim's passing was that moment to change their lives and do something else or change what they were doing, or it just didn't hold the same spice that it did. But for me, all of a sudden, we had some of these other, once again, more of the Diable group was starting to infiltrate. And as we got further back in the McLean, we were doing these really big, long trips.
And when you say the McLean, you're talking about the McLean River.
Yeah, okay, so after Tim died, we went back to pushing the Discovery Beyond Rands River ride, which, once again, I said, kind of led to this first river system, which was to the left would have been Milky Way heading up towards the quarry, and to the right heading down towards this Bruner Spring area. But it broke off almost immediately into this other room that led to what we called Wilson Way, because when we were plotting under the ground, it came really close to Wilson Pit, which is up in the highest ground, which we always had theorized if we could connect to Wilson Pit, we would not only have the longest but the deepest cave in Indiana. So that was always kind of the hope. So that passage going over there got called Wilson Way. So we were surveying on out that, and I was on a survey trip with Laura Demarest and Tim Pride and Shane Miles, Marion Akers, and Chris Parks, I believe. And so we had two leapfrog teams that we were surveying on down, and we were just getting lots and lots of passage. And all of a sudden, we got to this split where the passage went straight ahead one way and to the left on another way. And so Shane and Marion went straight ahead, and Tim Pride and Lauren, Chris Parks, I believe, and I went to the left. And we end up going up into this big perched overflow pool, which was filled with this really nasty kind of water. And we called it Loch Cess because it was this hanging cesspool that was almost 1,000 feet long
of
nasty water. But it was perched about 10 feet over the main stream. And all of a sudden, so Laura's setting point out there. And she all of a sudden yells out. She goes, "Oh my God, another river," something along those lines. And we get up there. And we're looking over the edge of this bank. 10 feet down is the biggest stream we've seen in the entire cave system. I mean, you know, the most beautiful emerald blue green you've ever seen. Everything you can think of. And I mean, we've just come through this horrible, nasty cesspool that if you got off the wrong thing, all of a sudden you were underwater in really nasty water, you know. And then all of a sudden we're looking at this and this, and they're going, "Oh my God." And they're like, "Well, can we get down the bank? Can we do this?" And I just kind of got over the side and slid on down with the water. So I didn't see it before, Laura, I was the first person to ever get my feet into the McLean River. And then we proceeded to take 1,000-foot shots upstream in the McLean before we turned around and met the other team back
and
there.
Left so much.
Yes,
to do.
I mean, set us up. So really, the next trip, which was kind of a big leapfrog trip, I think it was the next one, we went back to survey the McLean River.
Okay. Did the name McLean River come to you
immediately
as soon as you found
it? It's like
because,
Tim's Country Kitchen or McLean's Country Kitchen and stuff, and we were looking for something significant to name in the cave to name it after Tim. And it was like, this is Tim's River. This is the McLean River.
Awesome.
And it just kind of like, I mean, I think we were even calling it that before we were out of the cave, you know, and it didn't take anything to make it stick. But I mean, I can tell you what, Gary was so excited. I mean, he was about to come out of his shoes. He was so thrilled when we got out of that. We were so excited, you know, folks were excited, but they were also intimidated because it was so damn far back there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the brutality to get to this river is truly significant. Binkley's on a good day is daunting. Going back to where we're going there is you're getting into the most daunting trips in the cave.
So it takes how long to get there?
Just to get to the river, back then when we were, it was about 5 hours, I would say, just to get to the river. And you've got a mile of crawling in that.
Oh.
So, and then you've got suck mud that goes up to your hips.
Jeez.
You know, in different places. And so, but there's beautiful cave too. I mean, it sounds horrible, but it's also amazing.
Well, I mean, but if you got to get through something horrible, the travel is the travel.
It's just brutal. And so the next, we set up the next set of trips and it was a big leapfrog and Dave hadn't come back this far yet. And so he came back on this trip and we had, I want to say about 12 people, four teams doing leapfrog throughout the McLean River. And I remember being there and we were leaped by Laura and her team. And so we were surveying and you could just hear Laura squealing, just going on. And everybody's going, "Oh my God, she's found somebody out there." I said, "Finish your survey shots. We're going to be there in a minute," you know, because I didn't want to lose the survey and have a hanging survey. It's like, and we're hearing, "Row, row, row, row." It's like, we need to get up there. I said, "Finish your survey shots." So I had to be the survey Nazi to try and get them in there. And all of a sudden we get up there and here is, well, you've probably seen the picture on Joe Kinder's, you know, behind him and all his Zoom meetings on the walls and stuff is the McLean Mountain Room.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
It is. It's by far the biggest room in the cave.
Is it really?
I believe so. It's about 375 feet long, 65, 70 feet tall in places, and 100 feet to 125 feet wide, depending upon where you are.
Yeah.
And it was just phenomenal.
Wow.
And I remember Dave coming back from his leapfrog just the other side of the room, and he was starting to head out. And I could tell, you know, he was grappling with some things, and I think some of that was, you know, how far back we were in the cave and what it was taking to get back here and how much, you know, I could see kind of the wheels turning. I just knew Dave. And I already knew Dave was kind of at a point in his life, but that was really Dave's last big survey trip into the McLean River. I mean, it is so brutal to get back there, and the physical demands are amazing. And he had a whole lot of other reasons, but that was kind of, to me, was a real change from there on out. We finished up surveying that whole area out, but it became more kind of a hybrid between the ISS Vanguard and what I would call the Diable Vanguard. And we did more stuff. I mean, Greg McNamara and Val McNamara, Tony Akers, Mary Akers, myself, Tim Pride, Shane Miles, Joe Kinder. You know, it was kind of a different group altogether, kind of morphing now, but it was kind of this transitional group. And things really changed from that point on.
Mm-hmm. But as far as Dave goes, I mean, what a last trip.
Oh, my God. And I'm not saying that that was absolutely his last trip.
Of course not. But what a way to sunset sort of his main involvement.
Sure. Well, and he got a Lou Bicking, too. You know?
And he deserved it.
Absolutely. There was nobody that worked any harder than Dave. Mm-hmm. And he managed everything. And from the data to the trips and stuff. And I helped him do a lot of the foot on the ground kind of stuff, you know, here back home, because I lived there. So, and I did a lot of landowner relationships and things, but he also was excellent with that. But we just had a really great team, and it was one of the best runs ever with a group of people, cavers, I can imagine. Mm. Can't say enough good things about all of them. There's so many, I can't name them all, and I know I miss people.
There you go. Part one of a two-parter with Rand Hazlett. And next month, he shares his perspective on the 2016 flood, a story that's been shared by three other people on this podcast, three people who were there on an exploration trip in 2016 when an unexpected rain event flooded the cave and they were trapped for more than 36 hours. Rand was the leader on that trip. And so he shares that unique experience along with a lot more next month. Hey, thanks for listening. Support this podcast by supporting caving. Give to your local grotto, Karst Conservancy, or the NSS. Or support my sponsors, past and present. Of course, Sophie Reaptress. Get a nice cave suit. You deserve it. You know what else you deserve? A nice waterproof pack, a shiny new Swago, swagogear.com. Or if the grotto needs to fundraise, have Charlie Vetters make you some t-shirts out of his Greenfield, Indiana screen printing business, Organic Robot Designs. Or pick up a nice light, an El Spelio, now being sold by OnRope One. I'm Matt Pelser. I'll see you next month. Until then, kill nothing but time.